Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins. Hi, Pamela, and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens for our 67th episode.
Hi, Julie, and hi, everyone.
And, of course, last week was Children's Book Council of Australian official book week, which actually means most authors are basically at schools. Well, if we weren't in a pandemic, that is.
Yeah, I think it's becomes book month for many
Yeah,
authors.
Book month. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, busy week.
Now, there has been a flurry of Book Week costumes circulating on the socials, and I've actually seen quite a few Frankie DuPonts in my time. And it's a really wonderful time to celebrate books, school libraries, literacy, and the power of story. But here's the rub. The author's daughter refuses to dress up for Book Week. Point blank, absolutely no budging. Even when I visited her school as the author and read a story to the entire 500 kid assembly, dressed as Mary Poppins, she refused to dress up. So when everyone else is panicking about book week, I'm smugly reading more books. So, ha-ha! What else has been happening, Pamela?
Well, you and me both, because Manga Boy hated dressing up when he was younger, if anything. We have done a few, but of course, you know, we're homeschooling now, so yeah, we have to do it ourselves. So this year we discussed the costume thing, and, you know, we thought we might dress up for the fun of it, and they came up with some ideas, and instead we went to the beach.
Yay.
We did some, Manga Boy wanted to do some geocaching and some woodworking, and Joke Boy wanted to do some baking, so we did that, and we got the new 130-story treehouse book, which was beautifully timed to come out during Book Week.
Yes.
Andy Griffiths and Terry Denton. So we got that the day it came out, delivered from a local indie bookshop, Ben's Books, and then the next day, Andy Griffiths was doing a talk. I think it was for Better Reading Kids with Adrian Beck. So we watched that. And we watched a couple of David Walliams movies on ABC Me, and that was our book week done.
Oh, well done.
But, you know, as much as I'd love to do more, I don't really think my boys need it. They're already huge book fans. I don't have to encourage it anymore. So,
yes.
But I love that you had kids dressing up as Frankie DuPont. That's such high praise.
Oh, no. And, like, I think I took photos at the time, but you can't sort of post kid photos any. Well, people seem to do it, but I wasn't willing to do it, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think you've made it if you've got kids dressing up as your characters. It's awesome. Yeah.
Oh, it was beautiful. I've actually even had a kid do a Frankie DuPont fan fiction.
Oh, wow.
And they sent it to me, and I've still got it. Oh, it's amazing. Anyway.
Oh, so good. And otherwise, we are simply hanging out here in Melbourne to be released from our cages. It's been so wonderful to see the COVID case numbers come right down. Zero today. I think people have been calling it Donut Day because we've got 00. Especially, you know, it's so heartbreaking to see them so high in other countries. But, you know, after 6 months, we're really feeling it. And, we've been told that as of this week
Wednesday,
and, well, it will be yesterday once this goes live, and in 2 more weeks there will be more restrictions lifted. So I think I cried. I literally had tears today just seeing, you know, shops opening and we might be able to get back to sport soon somewhat after 6 months of a regular life. So relief. So what about you, Julie?
Well, butter icing paint fest continues.
You might be able to go to Bunnings soon in 2 days. You can go to Bunnings and the
this
rest
is
of the
funny.
city.
So I went to Woolies today to get something. And Woolies is, you know, so massive. We shop at Aldi because, you know, affordable. But anyway, I must have gone to get something from Woolies, like in the weird sort of home improvement aisle. And literally everything that I've been doing click and collect for was in the Woolies shop. I was like,
Aldi.
Oh my goodness. Like they've got spack filler, they've got painter's tape. Oh. I was just like, oh my goodness. I was waiting 2 days. Every time. And
oh,
like,
dear.
Oh, anyway, I will stop going on about it. But anyway, this is the other thing I thought you might get a chuckle out of. So HarperCollins, actually, they distribute for quite a few Australian publishers. And whenever we get a book, it's in this huge HarperCollins box.
Yes.
And there's a tiny book inside. And I think that's just their standard. That's the only size they have. So
yes.
Anyway, the boxes are starting to pile up. Because we receive a lot of books for the Mavens. So I decided to start using them as my paint box. So instead of dribbling paint here, there and everywhere, I simply put the paint tin in my HarperCollins box and shuffle it all around the house while I paint.
Great idea.
So there you go. Yes.
We've been using our boxes for also, actually some of them go out, but we've been saving them and the kids have been using them and reuse them to send stuff out because I, you know, sell
yes.
things, you know, so yeah. But
so thank you, HarperCollins.
Thank you, HarperCollins, yeah. And just back on the Bunnings thing, Manga Boy requested to do some woodworking. So
yes.
And I wanted to get a piece of timber that was longer than our car. So we actually got a Bunnings delivery.
Oh my goodness.
And because we didn't have half the tools.
You've jumped over the edge.
I was like, just the once we've got, you know, and there was like we had to get sandpaper, like it was $2 worth of sandpaper, you know, but we had this long bit of wood. So we got but no more deliveries. Thank goodness.
Yay.
We can go back to the shops.
Yes.
Anyway, shall we talk about books?
Yes. With those fascinating details, let's press on. Tell us, Pamela, what is the title of today's book?
Yeah, we are both doing one book today. It actually feels like a bit of relief because we've kind of been under the pump to do two books a week. And I have actually read an adult novel this week, which is, well, not this week, last
what?
Week. It's amazing.
What
it's
magic
just,
is this?
I know. And it's a series that I've been reading for years and years. And there's one new one every year. It's a spy thriller. And
I know
just,
the one.
Oh, I just had to read it. Anyway, and then I came to this one and I've been looking forward to this one all year. And it is
a long time.
Yeah. It is The Boy, the Wolf and the Stars by Siobhan Plaza, published in Australia by Puffin Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House Australia, on October the 20th, 2020.
Yes. And would you share the jacket blurb with us?
Well, in the copy that I have, which is, it's not a review copy, it's a full copy. There are 7 words on the back cover. So I thought I'd take the description from online and give you a bit more than 7 words.
Yep, sure.
Every night, Ulv is cloaked in total darkness, 12 hours ruled by the ravenous, clawing shadow creatures, beasts made of shadow and evil. Young Bo is charged with a monumental task, freeing the land of its curse by returning the stars to the sky. He must find 3 magical keys spread across the land. Keys that will unlock the cage holding the wolf who ate the stars. But there's another motive beyond saving Ulf. If Bo releases the stars, he can make a wish of his own and maybe find the mother who left him behind.
Oh, wow.
Hmm.
What genre? I nearly said what fantasy would you class this? What genre would you class this as?
I would class this as fantasy genre. Look, see, I can't even talk tonight. So, and the interview that I did with Siobhan as well, I'm just like, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Stumbling.
It's because we haven't spoken to people in real life.
Oh, do you know what?
Like,
yeah. Yep. No, that's the thing is we went out and met some friends in the park on Saturday and then I met a friend for coffee and then I stopped off at a friend's house to pick up Hi, Em. I know she's listening. To pick up some masks. I spoke to 3 real-life people Oh my
outside of my
gosh.
house in one day. It was like, I haven't,
No.
you know, so that's probably why I'm like,
Yep.
all talked out. Anyway, it is
And you
fantasy
go.
genre. Yeah.
Yep. And what is the estimated word count?
I think at a guess it's about 75,000 words.
Yep. Right up your alley.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, so young Bo was abandoned by his mother and his father is dead, so he lives with Mads on the edge of the forest. The villagers think he is cursed, that he's the reason for the shadow creatures haunting their village at night. The children shun him and Mads works him hard with little affection. But the situation worsens when Bo forgets to perform his daily chore of sprinkling the red gold dust around the oldest tree in the forest. The shadow creatures are becoming bolder. Then Rannik the wolf comes for Bo. Mads is killed, but Bo escapes. With his dying breath, Mads tells Bo that he needs to find the stars, because without stars, bad magic and the Shadow Witch will reign. Before leaving the village for good, Bo meets Tam, a Karaku, half human, half bird, and helps her escape her cage. And from Tam, he begins to learn about the wider world and about the wolf who swallowed the stars. Bo wants nothing more than a star to wish upon to bring back his mother. And with Tam's help, they begin the task of finding the three keys that will help them release the stars.
Oh, this is intricate.
It is. And yeah, it was actually
Yes.
kind of hard to pull out this thread of, you know, the main storyline, because it is very intricate and there's lots of you know, these
Yes.
different creatures and these different names. And, you know, so a lot of that probably didn't make
Yep.
much sense, but yeah,
No,
really
it
good.
sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
And what was your overall enjoyment?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I've been looking forward to this since Michelle Madden from Penguin mentioned it when I interviewed her all the way back in last summer. Remember when we did that
Yes.
the editor series? And yeah, it didn't disappoint. It is a beautiful, lyrical, folkloric book full of imagination and heart, as well as a few twists and turns. The story unfolds as Bo finds his courage and travels further from home and the life he knew. The world building is careful and considered with a dose of humor. It is a unique fantasy world with unique creatures, quite apart from the usual fantasy creatures, and some lovable characters. And there were some great lessons in acceptance and compassion. And I think this is a great book for middle grade fantasy lovers. And it has an interesting genesis, which you will hear about in my interview with the author Siobhan later on.
Yes. Who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
Yeah, I think it's perfect for ages 9 and up, and yeah, definitely fantasy lovers.
I've just bought so many books for Giselle already for Christmas, but I think I've got to get this one too.
Yeah, I think add it. I think she'll love it. Yeah, it's definitely one you can just dive into, and
Yes.
as you'll hear about in the interview, she came up with these names in a particular way, and they were so fun. But there was a lot of just little glimpses of humor and just this sort of personality through it, which I really loved. Yeah, really well written.
And the youngest son is opening up again, so I can just go and get it.
Oh, I know.
I can
How amazing
enter
is
a
that?
bookshop.
How amazing. I can't wait.
I possibly will cry
I
if I
know.
do
And I've just ordered. I mean, I'm always just ordering more books. So,
Yes.
I have to say, I think it's only 3 days away from the next Real Pigeons book coming out, which
Oh, wow.
Joke Boy is dying for. So
Yay.
we may just be able to walk into the shop and pick it up
Oh,
towards the end of the week,
dear.
which will be amazing. It'll just, oh yeah, it'll be so good. But yeah, buy this for yourself.
I will. I will.
So your turn, Julie. What is the title of your book today?
This one is ours by Kate O'Donnell. Cover by Astrid Hicks, published by UQP in October 2020.
And speaking of the younger son, this is Kate for the younger son,
Yes,
isn't it? Yeah.
it is.
Great.
Yes.
And could you share the jacket blurb with us, please?
Sure. Distractions come easily when you live in pursuit of beauty. 16-year-old Sophie is a dreamer, an artist, and a romantic.
when she goes on an exchange to Paris, she's expecting magnificent adventures of the heart and mind. Yet France isn't what she imagined. It's cold and grey, and she finds speaking another language exhausting. Sophie's more homesick than lovesick. But then her host sister Delphine and fellow artist Olivia shows Sophie a different side to Paris, and she starts to question her ideas about art, beauty and meaning, about everything. There's such truth in what her best friend Crow has been saying all along. The earth is in crisis and people need to take notice now. But what can one girl do? Will Sophie be able to find the courage to fight for change? This One Is Ours is a call to action for anyone who feels helpless about the state of the world, as well as an ode to all the tiny beautifuls that make it worth saving.
Oh, it sounds so lovely.
Oh, it's a beautiful book.
Yep. I have a friend whose name is Delphine and she's French.
Oh, it's such a French name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Obviously, but...
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And what genre would you class this as?
I'm going to say this is lower YA, which, as you know, we do not usually do. But, of course, this is our Kate, who supported us with her book recommendations from the Younger Son bookshop. So, of course, I had to read it and tell everyone about it.
Yeah, we've done a few sort of crossover lower YA. And it is interesting to see sort of that next step before you get into full-on YA.
Yes. I really like this lower YA kind of...
Yeah. I think younger teens seem to be reading, and because there hasn't been much distinction in the past between sort of the lower YA and the upper YA and then adults, and, you know, adults read YA. So it is nice to see that distinction of, okay, the lower end of the teens can read, you know, not can read, but, you know, these are more sort of, a little bit another step before the big, appropriate. That's the word. Yep. Thank you. So what is the estimated word count?
I'd say it's about 60,000.
Okay. It's not too bad. And can you tell us more about it?
Sure. Sophie has left her cozy life as a 16-year-old student who loves art and dreams of Paris, and she's actually gone to Paris, something she finds utterly astonishing. She's actually fulfilling her wildest dreams one day at a time. But Paris is not the idyllic destination. It has poverty and filthy streets and dreary weather and a language that Sophie struggles with, regardless of how well prepared she thought she was. Managing to keep her homesickness in check, she keeps going to school and art class, where she notices a mysterious boy named Olivia. One Sophie knows would probably never give her the time of day. So when an explosion happens in the Paris underground, Sophie finds herself being walked home by Olivia. Home walks turn into stolen kisses, and Sophie thinks that nothing in the world could be more magnificent than Paris. That is, until bushfires at home envelop her grandfather's house, burning it to the ground. Sophie is returned to the real world, where climate change is making her country burn, and she can no longer stand back and do nothing. Her best friend Crow is mounting a protest back home, and Sophie can help with poster graphics, but that is all. That is, until her enigmatic host sister Delphine shows Sophie another side of Paris, one that will change her world in more ways than travel and art and stolen kisses could ever do.
Oh, takes me back to being 13, 14.
Oh, yes.
Sounds like a great teen book. What was your overall enjoyment?
Well, as I've said, I do not read YA ever, unless you count my Twilight and Midnight Sun Confessions. But apart from those books, we are middle grade mavens, let's be clear. We are obsessed with middle grade books, but I can tell you once and for all, I may have to change my tune. I simply loved this book. Kate has such a unique and gentle voice in Sophie, and I was utterly enveloped in the details of Sophie taking her first trip to Paris. Now, I've been to Paris, and Kate captured Sophie's feelings so astutely, which are not unsimilar to my own, with rich and vivid explanations about the setting, including some French lessons along the way. They were so expertly done, I hardly noticed I was learning so much. I just totally bathed in Kate's delicious words and took joy in watching Sophie basically come of age as she learns that first love lost can either make or break you, but what really matters is changing the world in which we live in, one tiny beautiful step at a time.
Oh, I think I'm going to have to add this to my pile of books to read
over
summer. You have
to have this book, yeah.
I love Paris. I love
Paris. You will love
Paris.
It.
Oh dear, my book pile for the summer is getting so high right now. So who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
I'm going to say this will suit 14 plus.
Okay.
But I actually have no idea what YA readers really, I mean, that's so broad because, you know, we've got adults reading YA, but I'm going to say 14 plus. How's that?
Yeah, that sounds about
right. Yeah. Well, that is it for our reviews. And we have two super special treats in our interviews. First up, Pamela chats to Siobhan Plaza and then Kate O'Donnell, our very own, I'm claiming Kate forever, younger son bookseller, stops in for a chat.
She's been amazing.
Stay tuned, folks.
Yeah. Siobhan Plaza is an award-winning author of books for children and young adults. She is a frequent contributor to anthologies, and when she is not writing, she works as an editor and a manuscript assessor. The Boy, the Wolf and the Stars is her first middle grade novel. Hi, Siobhan. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. We're so glad to have you here, and I've just finished reading your book. It was absolutely lovely.
Thank you.
So tell me how this book got started. What was the original idea that sparked it?
Well, it was 20 years ago, actually. I discovered a book on Scandinavian folk belief and legend on a library shelf and devoured it and was fascinated by everything that was in there. And I ended up writing a short story sort of inspired by some of the things that I'd found particularly interesting in the book. And as I was writing the short story, I kept sort of thinking, I think there's more to this world and there's more to this character that I'm creating, this little boy who lives in the forest. And for 10 years after that, I sort of would occasionally come back thinking, oh, maybe I should revisit that short story. And and eventually I did, to 10 years ago. So it took 10 years to write the book. And by then, my idea of what the story could be had changed quite a lot. I'd been thinking about the Norse myth of Ragnarok and when the wolves jump into the sky and eat the sun, the stars and the moon. I sort of thought, well, that would be an interesting basis to build a world on, because as a child I was terrified of the dark, and I kept thinking, what would a world be like if you didn't have the stars and the moon in the sky at night time? It'd be pitch black and it would be absolutely terrifying. And so I sort of created the world around that idea, and I took that boy from that original short story and I put him in that world and let him go off on his adventure. So it's sort of started from there.
Wow, I love that it came from Scandinavian mythology. I didn't actually get that because I haven't read much. I read a bit of mythology. My kids are really into Norse mythology, so they actually would love to know that. And they love that Tolkien based a lot of his books on Norse mythology. So it's really interesting that you've used that, and I didn't actually realize that. So, and 10 years.
Yeah, that's the thing. Over the 10 years, it changed. I sort of started and I sort of drew on that inspiration a lot more explicitly in the beginning. But over the 10 years, as I developed it, I began to insert stuff that was a lot more original, things that I'd created myself. And I think sort of now there's nothing that's really terribly recognisably Scandinavian about it, really. Maybe there's a sort of a tone to it that's probably recognizable. But certainly all of the creatures and stuff, they're all, you know, they're not I haven't used them from any mythology. They're, you know, made up. So it had that beginning, but I think now it has moved away where, yeah, I think you could read it and not recognise that beginning point.
Yeah, it does have a folkloric feel to it, especially with the what is it, the scribe was writing throughout it, those little inserts. Yeah. And the wolf is quite symbolic, isn't it? In mythology, in terms of...
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it was kind of... I mean, it was fun to play, you know, trying to speak without too many spoilers here, but it was fun to play with what people expect from a wolf character and the fear that's usually derived from that. That's probably all I can say. But certainly, yeah, drawing on those sort of the archetypal sort of wolf character and how I could lean into that for a little bit and then kind of divert somewhere with it. So
And the main character of Bo, he's very naive. He lived at the edge of the forest and has spent most of his life doing chores. Was it difficult to remember as you wrote the book that he was so naive and he didn't have much knowledge of the world, and then to keep that consistency of character?
I think that wasn't the hardest part. The hardest part was keeping track of his emotional growth, which is probably tied into that, because as he's learning more about the world, as he's learning that things that he thought were true aren't, and that maybe certain people didn't have his best interest at heart that he thought did, it was about keeping track of his emotional reaction to moving away from naivety or ignorance or whatever it was, and coming to understand the world and his place in it. So I think it was a slight shift from what your question is, more to the idea of the emotional journey. And that's something I always struggle with when I'm writing a story, is keeping track of that emotional arc. And I don't know if it says something about me as a human being that I'm so terrible at teasing out my character's emotions on the page. And it's something that editors are always sort of having to pull me up on, say, no, let us know what the character's feeling in this moment. So I think that was the thing that I was most focused on. And to work on that, it really is a matter of sort of looking at jotting down cause and effect. So what's just happened to him in this moment? How does he feel about it? How's that going to lead into the next event? How does that then make him feel? How does he respond to that? Sort of, so you sort of just jot down dot points to make sure there's a consistent growth from where he is at the beginning to where he is at the end.
Interesting. You can definitely see that growth. You can see him, his courage and his boldness coming out. And that's a really interesting way of doing it. I've never thought of pulling it out and just, you know, writing it down as a separate thing.
I have to, otherwise I can't see it. I do make a lot of lists like that about all aspects of story when I'm writing it, because stories are just too big to see every aspect of it at once.
Yep.
So I find that I have to do a lot of just sort of little maps and stuff, I suppose, of so I can jot, you know, the plot arc or the character growth or, you know, what's happening with the magical plague, and like I have to separate things out and plot their journey just so I can see it, because I can't see it all together. My mind doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I started off with writing picture books, which you can see all that in one sitting, in one reading. And then, you know, as you get, as the books get longer, it's like, okay, there needs to be another way to manage this all in my head and manage it on the page. It's a great way of doing it. Yeah. And you know, the Bo and Tam and Serena? Celine, sorry. They're very well-rounded characters, very, compelling characters. I really love them. So the world that you've created, what did you call it? It's a second world. It's not set in the human world, and has these beautiful fantasy names. And there are so many of them and so many creatures. And there's a sort of humor element as well with some of these, pulling out these creature names. How did you come up with all these names, all these, you know, different fantasy names?
Yeah, that was, again, just process over time. Sometimes you can't find the right name at the time. You sort of have to put in a placeholder until you can find it. So one of the things that I would do would be to sort of start with a word that sort of summarized some aspect of what that creature was. And then I'd chuck it into, you know, Google Translate and see how it would sound in some mostly sort of Scandinavian languages, just to get those different sounds out. And that was sort of the first process that I tried. I never quite got anything that worked. And I remember watching an episode of QI once, mm-hmm. and they showed two shapes on the screen. And one was sort of like a round, blobby sort of shape, and one was like a sharp, had like lots of points. And they gave two words. I can't remember the words were, but one had very round sounds and one had sort of sharp, like, you know, CK sort of sounds and stuff. And they said, you know, which shape is named which word? And everyone gave the round, blobby shape the word that sounded round, and everyone gave the one that had the spikes to it, the sharp sounding name. And at the end they said, well, actually the shapes are completely made up as well as the words. And they sort of talked about how we associate sounds with physical things. And I began to use that kind of process. So I would think about what that thing was and what sort of just sounds made sense for what that creature was. Was it going to be something that needed hard sounds, and or did it need long, round sounding vowels? And like, and so I sort of broke it down that way and would literally just sort of on a piece of paper sort of grab a few different syllables that sounded right for what that creature sort of represented, and just sort of chuck them in different orders till I came up with a word that sounded like what that creature was. And I found that that was the most effective method, and that's when I started coming up with names for things that felt right. So yes, it was a long process of trying to think of sounds that felt right and plotting them on the page, and so they went through lots of changes and stuff. But yes, it was that process. And I'm sure there's some scientific word for what I did, but I sort of muddled my way through.
It's an interesting part of linguistics, I think.
Yeah.
And I've been reading up on poetry, like doing a poetry course, and they talk a bit about those sounds and you know, why you would use more shushing sounds if you're talking something gentle, or you're talking about, you know, the sea and yeah, those sharper sounds for other things. And I can see that in the Tam. She's a Koraku, so she's got and she's a part human, part bird, so that does sound like that.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting process. I love that. So once you got the contract, now you took 10 years to write it, how much editing was involved afterwards?
Do you know what? There was still a bit to do even after it was contracted and we started working on it. The work's mainly concentrated in one particular area that I hadn't been able to get to work. The rest of it was sort of your basic stuff that always sort of needs to be fixed. So there were still some significant changes that took place, but they were all pretty much just in the first half of Act Two, where I knew, even submitting it, that I wasn't happy with how that was, but I needed to bounce ideas off someone to work out how to fix it. And in the end, I'm really happy with how it changed. And it was an interesting process of how it changed, because my editor actually asked me to write out a document sort of detailing all of the aspects of the world and the history of the world that doesn't feature anywhere in the story, But she just wanted to understand herself. And I think she kind of wanted me to be a little bit more conscious of my world building. And in writing that document, I uncovered the stuff about the Unking. And as soon as I started writing about him as a character and the history of what had happened to the royal family of the Irons, I suddenly knew what to do with that first half of Act Two. So in a roundabout way, the editing process helped me fix that. It wasn't the usual sort of way of the editor saying, you know, explicit things on your manuscript. But it was, I think, if she hadn't have asked me to do that, I wouldn't have come up with that fix. It would have been a bit more of a Band-Aid fix, and it wouldn't have been half as good, I don't think.
It's sort of like the advice that you get to write down everything you can about your character, even if it isn't in the story. Mm-hmm. Know your character so well that their reactions and their decisions make mm-hmm. sense. And, you know, the reader can know your character, even though they don't know some of those things that you've written down. That's an interesting way of doing it.
And I thought I knew all that stuff. I thought it was in my head. Mm. But the process of writing it down let me see where there were gaps and where there were things that were still pretty vague that I hadn't really thought through as far as I needed to think them through. So I think that it's really, really easy to tell yourself that you do know your world, but unless you've actually really written it down, there's likely to be gaps in there, I think. So that's definitely something I've learnt to do when writing fantasy in particular, is you write out a document that sort of details every aspect of that world. It's incredibly helpful.
It's interesting. I have to keep that in mind. So I know you've written a couple of YA books before you wrote this one. How does writing for the middle grade audience differ from writing for young adults?
Well, it was interesting because I started writing The Boy, the Wolf and the Stars before I wrote either Frankie or Tin Heart. They sort of appeared in the middle because over those 10 years I would write in it for a little bit and then put it away and work on other projects and stuff. So I was actually writing for the middle grade audience first. It hasn't appeared until now. And I think because I read so widely when it comes to middle grade and YA, the shift in voice that's required wasn't as big a deal maybe as what it could have been. Like I found myself relaxing into a different voice without too much trouble. The difficulty came, I think, in switching genres. So moving from contemporary to fantasy, that's where I sort of had to really work through how to make that shift. And that all comes down to world building, because my two YA books were set in suburbs in where I lived. So it was really, I knew every aspect of those suburbs. I knew what street led to what street and what it smelt like and the sounds, and you know all those things, you know, intrinsically. But when you're creating a world from scratch, you don't know any of those things. You have to invent all of those things. So that aspect was different. But I suppose the one thing though that I was particularly conscious of when shifting between YA and middle grade was the difference in pacing. And again, that is, that comes down to genre as well, between contemporary and fantasy, but definitely also between middle grade and YA, that you have to think about the pacing of your story in very different ways. So with the middle grade, I was always conscious of not rushing the story, but trying to find the right pace. So we're still moving along. It's still an adventure. In that, you know, my reader's going to be swept along with it while hopefully still having the breathing space to spend time with the characters, getting to know each other and their emotional journey as well. So it was about, walking that sort of that tightrope and getting the pacing right.
And that's different with fantasy, because there's a lot of world setup, a lot of world building that has to go on while you're bringing in the characters and moving the story along. And there's a lot that needs to go on, particularly at the start. So that engagement is
a fine sort of juggling act, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's probably why it did take me so much longer to finish it, because I was worried I was never going to be able to get that balance right. And it took me a while to work out how best to do that. But now that I've sort of done it once, I feel a lot more confident, and I feel like I understand what the pacing feels like in a middle grade fantasy, and I can sort of replicate that with a little bit of, with more ease. Still never easy, of course. It's always a very difficult task. But at least because I've done it once, I know what it feels like. And I think that really helps.
Yeah. Every book is different. Every book has its own challenges.
Yes.
And your readership has changed with this book from the other two. And, you know, we have a pandemic to in the mix there. So how have you engaged with your readers for the launch of this one?
I mean, not much yet. So I've done some virtual school visits. We just had book week. So I've done some visits for that. And got some more sort of virtual visits and stuff lined up, but my hands are sort of tied because it's hard to reach a middle grade audience anyway. And there's always that question of who is your audience, who's your buying audience, and who's your reading audience. They're two different things.
Gatekeepers.
And you know, you have to think about how you're reaching both of those audiences. And it's slightly easier for me to still reach maybe the buying audience because I can do online events for librarians and parents and stuff. But it's difficult to engage directly with kids outside of school visits. Because they're not someone that you can easily approach on the internet, nor should you easily approach them on the internet. Yeah. You have to be extremely careful with that sort of thing about how you're approaching their space. So there's very little I can actually do other than hope. Yeah. Hope that the word sort of trickles down and the people that I wrote the story for get to read it. So I don't know. I mean, that's a really difficult question, especially, I mean, this is sort of the first week that the book is out as well.
But
to be perfectly frank, the opportunities to engage with my audience are limited.
And they've only been back at school now in Melbourne for a couple of weeks. So, well, no, a week, I think.
And only some of them as well, I think. Yeah,
and not all the grades too, which, you know.
Kids have had a awful time for a lot of reasons, and one of those reasons is, you know, that Zoom schooling is so extra exhausting, and the isolation and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's, are they going to want to spend their afternoon after they've spent all day online for school, you know, going to an author talk or whatever? So, and probably not, and nor should we try and force them to. They need to relax and go outside and play in the backyard or whatever. Yeah. So you just sort of have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, this isn't about me at the moment. Their mental well-being has to be first and foremost. So,
I spoke with a teacher friend of mine. I spoke with a teacher friend of mine this morning who said at the moment their focus is just on getting the kids to socialise and just be, you know, relaxed together rather than pushing academics and things like that. So hopefully there's some librarians listening who can whisk your book into their library and into some hands by way of, so I know that you are fully immersed in the world of words, something that I really aspire to. How do you juggle your writing time with editing and manuscript appraisals, and how do you not get tired of looking at words all day?
To be honest, I have gotten tired of that, and I have pulled back a little bit from non-writing tasks like that because I did find it kind of exhausting, because you are using the same muscles and you're using that muscle that is kind of also something that is a creative outlet that you're supposed to love as well, and connecting every aspect of it to, you know, commercial enterprise is a awkward thing to do. Mm. So I have sort of pulled back a little bit on that, so that I've got plenty of mental energy to focus on my writing, because that's the key thing that I want to be doing for my job. And in response to that, I've taken up painting and drawing again, because I needed a creative outlet that was not tied to how I earn my money.
Yeah.
Because I want to be creative and not worry about whether or not it's going to pay the bills. I just want to exercise that part of my brain with no sort of expectation on it. And that's been really helpful and really important. But I do like still dipping into the editing and manuscript assessing side of things, because it does, one of the things that I found when I first retrained in that area was just how helpful it was with my own writing, because it gave me the language to use and the tools to use to fix my work and to be able to pinpoint what's not working and why isn't it working in ways that before was sort of a vague instinct of, like, I sort of kind of know something's not working now. I don't quite know why it's not working. And when you're training and editing and stuff, it gives you that understanding of why things perhaps aren't working and how you go about fixing them. So, and sort of looking at other people's work is really helpful to sort of begin to view how stories work in a more objective way than when you're just looking at your own writing.
Mm.
So it is still helpful for me to sort of dip my toes in with that kind of thing, just to keep that part of my brain well exercised. But it is an exhausting thing if you have every aspect of your life tied to one particular thing, especially if that thing is, you know, something that's a creative passion, because then that thing that you would normally be doing to find joy in the world and to explore the world is sort of, you have all those added stresses of is it going to sell and are people going to read it and all those sort of awful questions.
Mm.
Be very demoralizing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't quite have that worry. I mean, no, I do, because I'm trying to, you know, I want to be published and I have sold some work, but I do a lot of reviewing and I volunteer edit a magazine, and I sometimes I just get to the end of the day and I'm like, I'm so sick of words. Mm-hmm. You know, but give me a day or two and I'm like, give it all to me again, you know.
Yes.
So I get it. I just don't quite have the pressure of contracts to worry about just yet. So now, you said that you do read a lot of middle grade novels. Is there a middle grade novel that you think that all children should read?
Oh, no, because I don't think there's any such thing, because everyone has such different tastes, and, you know, you've got to find the book that works for you. I used to work as a school teacher, and there's nothing more sort of heartbreaking than when you hand off a book you've just read and you think it's the best thing ever, and you hand it to a student, they look at it and go, meh. You just think, why don't you love it? So I just think, and then you can't force that on kids, because as soon as you start trying to do that, well, then they begin to associate negative things with reading, and if they're not enjoying what they're reading, well, then they'll stop reading. So there's definitely certain books that I've loved and I would love to see lots of kids read, but I don't think there's any sort of single book that is going to suit every reader.
Yeah, I see that with my kids. You know, I do all these reviews for the podcast, and half the books my kids haven't read. they have their own complete interest areas and styles that's different from mine. And it's actually interesting, because I received a book the other day that I'd never heard of before, and my son just went, oh my gosh, I have to read this. And I was like, oh, I love that.
Fantastic. Yeah.
He's like, can I have this? I'm like, well, I have to read it, because it's been sent to me for review, but you can have it. So yeah, great answer. Now, what's coming up for you? Will you be writing more middle grade, or are you going to continue with some YA for a while? Do you have anything coming out?
Very awkward to ask that question to someone in publishing because we always have so many long-term secrets. I can't talk about anything specific yet, but I certainly I would like to write more middle grade. I would like to keep working in the fantasy realm. Yes.
Sounds great. That's what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear that. Okay, Siobhan, are you ready for our 6 quick questions?
No, but I will attempt them anyway.
All right, it won't hurt. keyboard or pen and paper?
Keyboard.
Favorite writing snack?
Oh, rice cakes.
Oh, okay.
Plain. I love them.
Do you? I'm so addicted to rice cakes with honey on top of them at the moment.
My snack. I hate them.
Okay. Normally I would eat chocolate, but I'm not allowed to eat chocolate at the moment, so rice cakes and honey. Tea or coffee?
Tea. I've never tasted coffee in my life.
Oh, interesting. Don't start.
No, I
want to. It's hard to start. Ebook or the real thing?
A real thing.
Cats or dogs?
Cats, 100%.
Oh. And comedy or tragedy?
Comedy.
Nice. And so where can our listeners find you if they want to find out more?
They can usually find me on Instagram or Twitter, and links to both of those are on my website, siobhanplaza.com, where there's information about all of my books. And you can even check out, I've got the map that's in the front of The Boy, the Wolf and the Stars. I've got a nice sort of drawn version of that on my website. You can have a look at as well and explore the world that the book takes place in.
The map is beautiful, and the front cover, I have to say, I love the front cover.
Gorgeous, isn't it?
It's gorgeous. Yeah, well, thank you for joining me today, Siobhan. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Kate O'Donnell is a writer specializing in children's and young adult literature. She has a BA in History and French from the University of Melbourne and studied professional writing and editing at RMIT. Untidy Towns was published in 2017, and This One Is Ours was released in October 2020, which we had the pleasure of reviewing. Kate has also featured quite a few times on Middle Grade Mavens in her role as bookseller at the wonderful Younger Son Bookshop in Yarraville. So be sure to check out those episodes. So hi, Kate, and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens.
Hi, Julie. Thank you for having me.
Now, we spoke about this book off air many months ago when you were in the thick of editing and structural notes. And now that it's in the world, what has been your highlight so far?
Already been a lot of highlights. I think the book's just had such a wonderful welcome into the world, and I'm so grateful. UQP organised a blog tour in the first week the book was published, and it was such an ego boosting time with lots of nice things said about Sophie and the story.
Yes.
But
yes.
The highlight comes from Bree at Jasper and Spice, who talked about how books that push an agenda or portray activism often turn them off, but they really connected with Sophie. And I quote, truly gave me the push to educate myself truly in the happenings of the world instead of running from it. And I just felt that's exactly what I hoped would happen.
You've done your job, Kate.
I've peaked.
Don't peak too soon. Oh, that's brilliant. And I attended your lovely Zoom launch, so I know a little bit more about you, but for our listeners, tell us, where did the idea for This One Is Ours spring from?
I think like a lot of books, it comes from a lot of different interests in a person's life, a writer's life. But since I was studying French and history at Melbourne Uni, I became pretty obsessed, one might say, with the political movement in France in 1968, which was a protest sort of it was a time of upheaval all through the world. So it was sort of the sum of its parts, but it, the students in Paris took control of the university and they barricaded the streets, and a group of artists created a sort of a guerrilla art organization called the Atelier Populaire, and they created the most iconic posters of the time that they spray painted everywhere. They posted up different posters, and you can see throughout history since how people have used and changed these and adapted them. And I just really struck me creatively. So I've always wanted to sort of work that into a story somehow. And it just sat there percolating. Yep. And then in the last couple of years, as I've watched the School Strike for Climate movement and Greta Thunberg just sort of come and tell us how we need to be doing things, it really solidified what I wanted the story to be about.
Yeah.
And, of course, yep. Paris and my love of France.
Of course, yes. Oh, it's a brilliant beginning, in other words. And I think I think I know this, but I've asked it anyway. Did you actually write this while you were in Paris at all, or did you just take notes and come home and have to recreate it?
I think I started it possibly when I was living in France, or an idea of what this story, like a little one of those little gems that then became this book many, many years later. So I was living yep. in France in 2006, and I definitely started it then, but in a very different form. But no, I just wrote it over the last sort of 3 years since Untidy Towns came out. I started writing it just after that. But I've been lucky enough to go to France once or twice during that time. And yes. I had written pretty much the whole book, and I spent a month in Paris, and I sat at cafes with my manuscript and I walked the streets that I wanted to write about. So that was pretty special.
Oh, living the dream. Oh, that's amazing. Especially having that, you know, that first, well, wouldn't have even been a first draft. It would have been a mini draft down, and just honing it. Oh yes. Like, and you yeah. could tell that you just honed this so beautifully. Like, it was so on point.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh. And as I said, it's a beautiful coming of age tale set in France amidst a backdrop of art and first love and climate change. How hard was it to mix in the French spoken words and the details of the setting and balance it with all those themes?
It was a big challenge, and I hope that I've pulled it off. I think that's my biggest fear about the book, is that I wanted to include so much, and it's a yeah. little book. It's actually quite short. I think it's not much over maybe 60,000 words, maybe more, I can't remember, but yes. it's little. And I know the dilemma of including the French language, I'm still nervous about it. I think because I speak French, not fluently, but I do speak French, I'm very used to seeing those words in yeah. my life and in my head. And so I hope that I've struck that nice balance for readers where you don't, one, feel like you're at school learning something, but also that you don't feel like the book is being too cool for you or too, like, sort of blocking you out somehow.
Yeah.
And so I worked really closely with Kathy, my editor, to sort of make sure that we did try to strike that balance.
Yep.
And when it came to the detail of the setting, like, I wanted to be very careful not to go on for pages and pages describing yes. where Sophie was at any given time, because that's just not how I write. But also I hope that I gave enough flavour.
You did.
And
yeah. also because you knew that your French friends would be reading this.
I know, I'm nervous going, about that.
That's
I need
not,
to put the books
not
in the
where
post.
The croissants are.
I know. I'm nervous about French people or people who've been to Paris reading it and seeing inaccuracies. I did include a disclaimer in my author yeah. note.
Oh, it's like anything. Like,
well,
I mean,
to make fiction work, you have to
yes.
you have to make a few things up.
You've got to fiction it up.
Exactly.
And what was your favourite part of the book writing process?
it's always the beginning. It's so much fun when you're just creating this world and this character, and there's so much freedom. And even though I had a contract for this book, so I knew that it was something that would hopefully be published, they can always say no in the end. Yeah. But it's just so wonderful. That time is my favorite, and the editing process is not my favorite.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I'm an editor, but
I know. I'm the opposite. Hard. I hate the beginning. I just loathe it. And then when I've got those words down, I'm like, you know, rolling around like a pig in mud with all these magnificent words that I've made.
Oh, no, you're right. There is something special about revisiting something and seeing that it's come together. That's pretty special.
Right. And I always feel like some alien wrote it. Like, who wrote those words? I did not write those words.
I love that. Well, I actually read a passage in Untidy Towns. I was looking through my own book, as you do, and I'm pretty sure I stole something from a different author. So I should probably accidentally, like, not then an alien did write it, but
What do they say about, you know, it's the highest form of, I can't even.
Flattery.
Flattery.
Hopefully.
And the cover by Astrid Hicks is, of course, fantastic. It is everything. Is it everything you envisaged, or did Astrid take it even further than you imagined?
She always takes it further. I think because of this obsession I had with these posters from the Atelier Populaire in May 1968, I had in my mind, I guess, I just had this image of, you know, a spray painted stencil-y sort of thing.
Yes.
And but I had, like I did with the other book, I put together a Pinterest board of all like the different inspirations for while I was writing, because that's nice. I like to look at lots of different pictures. You know, who wants to look at Paris? I do always.
Yes.
And I sent that to Astrid, and I'm so grateful to her and to the team at UQP for working with her. Because when I saw what she'd done, it was just perfect. And this is the only cover I saw. We saw a couple of different colours and a couple of different font choices. But like, I think the team at UQP knew that it was just perfect.
And I could not imagine it in a different colour, to be honest. I'm just like, no, 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 that colour has to stay.
Yeah, I know. And it's pretty funny. Someone pointed out the other day that everyone's like, do you have that book in a bookshop? The cover was blue. And I was like, yes. Oh, no, I'm one of the blue.
Yes. But maybe it's... You've joined the blue revolution.
I love it.
So speaking of other books, is there a book that came out during the pandemic or that you know, sort of knew was coming out that you'd love to give some love to? And it can be in any age group.
Well, I like how you said a book, because of course I'm going to talk about a couple.
70. Yeah.
So one, but this first book I did work on at Scribble. So there's a disclaimer for everybody, but Howl by Kat Patrick and Evie Barrow is a picture book that has spoken to my heart before the pandemic, but oh my God, did it get its claws in during the pandemic? So it's just a story of a little girl called Maggie who's had a terrible day and has all these enormous feelings. And it's about her learning that she can let them out and that her mum and that Wolf Mum and Wolf Gran will be there to love her and to work with her through these feelings. I've needed a howl or two in the past few months. And as middle grade goes, everyone at the younger son has really enjoyed both Sunflower by Ingrid Laguna and January Stars by Kate Constable.
Yep.
Highly recommended both of those. And I've just finished in the past couple of weeks a YA novel called Future Girl by Asphyxia, who is a deaf author from Melbourne. And she's written this near future Melbourne where people are afraid to eat wild food. That's what they call food. And they eat these like protein bars basically that are sent by a big corporation, but it's about food security. And like, I feel like Asphyxia and I should do an event together, because I feel like Sophie and now I can't remember what Future Girl's name is, Piper and Sophie would get along. But I've only done a short course in Auslan, so I'll have to practice.
Oh, I'm so jealous that you're so much further ahead. Like, I'm not even on the journey, but I am dying to do Auslan, so
it's really great. Highly recommend it. I even think just having done 3 months or so, just has made me a better person. I can be a better citizen. Yeah. So
yeah. And what is next in the wings for Kate O'Donnell? Is there a project marinating or in full flight?
Definitely marinating. I did this thing I promised I wouldn't do, which was finish a book and
not start a new one
on the go. So I need to get started. I'm excited to write something probably for young adults again. I think that's my place at the moment, and I want to write something joyful and I want to have a bit of fun. So I don't know yet, but I'm thinking of doing NaNoWriMo. So hopefully at the end of November, I'll have some words to roll around in.
I just sent a text to Pamela the other day saying, I'm considering NaNoWriMo. And she was like, what? Because we don't do Nano. We do JanoWriMo.
Okay.
So usually January, because November, December are terrible for parents. But I was marinating on it. And I'm like, I might just do this. And I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Well, I was encouraged because Alison Evans said they're just going to do 10,000 words.
Oh,
and I think that's a better goal. So I might even do something like that.
10,000 is so, I mean, I might even get it up to 20, but 10 is so workable. I'll have to stop painting the house and then I can do NaNo. But I am looking forward to seeing what you pull out, because this one was so beautiful. So, I mean, you can't peek too soon, but you also have to keep peeking. So more you. Kate O'Donnell,
so
please.
Wonderful to hear.
Oh, it was a beautiful book. And how do our listeners find you if they're interested in checking out your books?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Reading Kate, one word, obviously. And I'm very active and happy to meet people over there.
Beautiful. And I think that's everything. I feel like we've just breezed through that so quickly because it was such a beautiful book. Like, we need to tease it out more, but yeah, anyway.
All good things must come to an end.
They must. And like usually, because I have like word count issues and I think I was saying to Pamela, oh, and it was really short. I loved it. So. Well, short for me is 60,000. So,
No. Well, I had these visions of it being sort of 40,000 word almost novella, but I got talked out of that.
Oh, well done. No, it was just a perfect amount. So, anyway, Kate, thank you so much for joining us, and we can't wait to see what you come up with next at NaNo, and also come back to us soon and give us some more younger son updates.
I'd love to. That would be great. Now we can open again.
I know. They're first on my hit list. I'm going to be there.
Looking forward to seeing you.
Send that Julie girl home. Thanks again, Kate.
Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by Middle Grade Mavens. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com or to find Julie online, stop by julieandgrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.ueckerman.net.